Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 23rd of November, these are our main stories. Donald Trump has said he would like a full trial in the US Senate if Congress votes to impeach him. Bolivia's interim government has accused the ousted president, Evo Morales, of sedition and terrorism after he called on his supporters to maintain blockades. In Lebanon, thousands of anti-government protesters have again taken to the streets as the country celebrates its Independence Day. Also in this podcast, Japanese parents fail to overturn heartbreaking child custody laws and a coded cry for help in a call to emergency services.
911.
I would like to order a pizza.
You called 911 to order a pizza? This is the wrong number to call for a pizza.
No,
I'm getting you now.
Let's begin in Washington, where on Friday, Donald Trump spoke at length to Fox News Television about the impeachment hearings against him.
Frankly, I want a trial. You know, I could think I could have it.
You want a trial?
Whatever I want. Oh, I would. Look, number one, they should never, ever impeach. This is not impeach. I watched five people on your network yesterday say there's nothing here.
The president railed against the two-week public segment of the hearings into his alleged attempt to coerce Ukraine into investigating unsubstantiated claims about Joe Biden, a possible challenger for the presidency next year. Our Washington correspondent, Aleem Makbul, told me more about Mr. Trump's interview.
It was a meandering phone call, I suppose is a kind way of putting it. He focused a lot on the impeachment proceedings and the bias as he saw it in the whole process. He talked about Democrats making themselves look like fools through this process and, as you heard there, called for it to go to trial. But he did some of the very things he's been criticized for over the last couple of weeks. Intimidating witnesses, for example. He focused very much on one of the witnesses who came forward, Marie Ivanovich, who was the U.S. ambassador to Kiev until she was removed from office in the summer. And he suggested that she had been an Obama person and had refused to put up his portrait in her office. And the truth of the matter is that she had been ambassador under many presidents of both parties. And there's no suggestion that she was an Obama person. And actually, although he is certainly trying to portray this process as being entirely stilted, actually what we saw in those public hearings over the last couple of weeks is that a lot of the witnesses were career civil servants, even military heroes, who actually wanted to work for the Trump administration, but they saw what was going on and felt it was improper and had to report it.
Did he offer any evidence for his claims of bias and unfairness?
No. Well, I talked about what he said about Marie Ivanovich, for example, and he didn't necessarily go any further into substantiating those claims. But he also repeated other claims which had been called dangerous by intelligence officials over the last couple of weeks, specifically the peddling of this conspiracy theory that it wasn't Russia that interfered in the 2016 election, but it was Ukraine. And again, without offering a great deal of evidence, he peddled that conspiracy theory. Again, he also was pushing on another point, which, you know, he'd received a lot of criticism for, which is really focusing on the whistleblower, the person who started all of this. And he talked about wanting to know the identity of that person, for that to be revealed. So really, flying in the face of all the criticism he's received over the last couple of weeks, it was more of the same.
Briefly, is the president likely to get his wish and face a trial in the Senate?
Well, he may well do, because ultimately this is a political process. Democrats lead the House of Representatives. They are the majority there. They, over the next couple of weeks, first they'll decide whether they want to hear any more witnesses. Then they will draw up articles of impeachment if they do choose to move forward, which is essentially a charge sheet, and vote on whether this does go to a trial in the Senate. That is likely to happen. When it goes to the Senate, And this is the crucial thing, is that's where his party, the Republicans, have a majority, and that's where they'll decide whether he has to leave office, and that seems very, very unlikely.
Aleem McBool in Washington. Bolivia's interim government has accused the ousted president, Evo Morales, of sedition and terrorism. The country's main city, La Paz, has been choked by roadblocks for weeks, causing food and fuel shortages. Mr. Morales, who fled to Mexico after weeks of protests, tweeted the legal action against him was a farce. Here's our America's editor, Candace Peart.
Bolivia's caretaker government filed a complaint against Evo Morales while investigations began into the activities of his allies, who they accuse of fomenting unrest. Officials cited a telephone recording, which they alleged was Mr. Morales ordering supporters to blockade Bolivia's cities. La Paz has been choked by roadblocks for weeks. Meanwhile, the Congress is debating when to hold a new election. The disputed presidential vote last month sparked nationwide protests in which dozens have died.
Our America's editor, Candace Peart. Independence Day in Lebanon, when the country commemorates the end of French control in 1943, is usually a grand military affair with rolling tanks and marching soldiers. But this year it was scaled down considerably, and the protesters who've been on the streets for weeks celebrated that as their victory. They held their own demonstrations and spoke of real independence. Earlier, I asked our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, what the protesters mean when they talk of real independence.
They feel that in this, the past few weeks, when they've gone out onto the streets, and this has involved people from all parts of Lebanon, from all the different sects, from all the different classes, that unity has essentially put them above the sectarianism, the corruption, the politicians, the dynasties, the families that have run the country for decades, that that's their independence from that system, and that they've established themselves by being on the streets. Essentially, they had a carnival rather than the stiff military parade that usually happens. They mimicked that parade by making flags from the areas from which they come, making flags for the professions that they're part of. Even expatriates made their own little parade in which they had their suitcases with them. Again, that's a comment on the fact that so many Lebanese feel their only future economically is outside the country.
Why was the military parade cancelled?
Well, that's because of the pressure on the streets, essentially. It wasn't something that was going to be allowed to happen by the people. I mean, I was there a day or two ago when they stopped a parliamentary session happening. And again, that was very well organised. I mean, they called people out to come early in the morning to block the roads which lead to the parliament. They did the same thing again today, but on an even bigger scale. I mean, this was a real resurgence, well planned, of the protests and beyond the protests. I mean, a celebration of themselves and the new Lebanon that they believe they're beginning to conjure with each day that they spend, each small victory that they are able to score against the elite.
Briefly, what next?
Well, it's a long process. A lot of the people involved in the protests understand this and said that to me, that they are there to win bit by bit. The political elite are essentially paralysed at the moment. They can't find a new prime minister. They can't find a way out of this crisis. They're looking increasingly uncomfortable. They couldn't even get, as I say, into parliament to hold a session. So, you know, the protests continue, and what they really are concerned about is making it a very Lebanese way of doing it, with celebrations and without bloodshed.
Sebastian Usher. The Indian government has revealed that more than 30,000 of its citizens have died working in the Persian Gulf region in the past few years. Advocates and campaigners say poor working conditions and lack of adequate medical care are major factors. Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etarajan told me more.
The numbers are staggering. Not many people talk about this, you know, because going to the Gulf country, any country, Kuwait or UAE or Qatar, it's literally a dream for anyone from the rural areas of India or Pakistan or even Bangladesh. You know, the dream of going and working in Dubai in 5-10 years, earn enough money, you come back with television, refrigerator, or you come and build a house, your neighbors look at you with pride. So one guy does that and everyone wants to do it. First, why they want to go? Because there are not enough jobs within the country. And even agriculture, you can't do to because of water scarcity. So this has become a trend in the last 30, 40 years in South Asia for people to go all the way to the Gulf. But the conditions there are appalling. You know, people live like 20, 25 people in small rooms, and people pay money to the agents. You know, we're talking about $1,000, $2,000, which is a huge amount for an average Indian or even Pakistani. And they have to go first repay the debt. That builds a lot of stress, and then the heat, long working hours. That's what the activists say. These are the things which contribute to these deaths.
And then the access to medical facilities is dependent essentially on your country of origin.
Yeah, what happens is there are companies which can provide some healthcare. For example, I interviewed a worker from Nepal. He went to Qatar. He was working in one of these football World Cup sites, and he fell down and he had a big crack on his spine. So he was paralyzed. So he was stranded for weeks, and then he was airlifted thanks to other workers and his company. They didn't do any treatment. What they did was just to put him on a plane. They used all the money, whatever money they were supposed to give him, and sent him back to Nepal. When I visited his family on the outskirts of Kathmandu, he had a family to support, but he was on wheelchair. And even within the Nepal, he had to spend more money. He was not having any money. He was not getting any compensation. This, you come across any village in South Asia, you'll find two or three cases. As we speak from Bangladesh, every day, dozens of women, domestic workers, are coming back from countries like Saudi Arabia, alleging abuse, alleging sexual abuse, and also ill treatment. They couldn't work for such a long hour. So this is a huge issue. On the other hand, you have to think, for India alone, 6 million people working, and they send a huge amount of money back to their home. It's running the economy. So the governments really can't put pressure on, a country like Saudi Arabia. And same with Bangladesh. How can they, put pressure on Saudi Arabia to, give equal treatment or proper treatment? Because these countries need the money from the Gulf, and they run the services there. And the money coming back from these countries, they run the economy. For example, Bangladesh earns about $16 billion from expatriate workers.
Anbarasan Etarajan. Still to come in this podcast, a Belgian couple convicted in absentia of killing a British businessman have been arrested in Ivory Coast after decades on the run. And we hear from a doctor trying to connect Nigerians to mental health services.
The psychiatrist was Nigerian, and he told me, "You're very lucky." He dawned on me that I was one of the less than 1% of people that could access quality help.
When the law and human emotion collide, the cost can be heartrending. That's certainly the case in Japan, where parents who've become estranged from their own children have failed in a legal bid to make the government enforce visiting rights. I heard more about the case from our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
The parents were arguing that their constitutional rights had been dismissed because they had been granted visitation rights, but those rights were being ignored. Those visitation times were not being respected by the other parent. And so the parents in court were saying that the Japanese government had been ignoring their rights. However, the judge in the Tokyo court disagreed with that.
And there was quite a lot of opposition to any change in the law coming from some parents who had divorced.
That's right. So child custody has been a big issue in Japan for a long time. That's because Japan's quite unusual among highly developed, wealthy countries in that it awards custody to simply one parent after a divorce, usually the mother. 80 to 90% of the time, the mother automatically gets custody. And then the mother is under no obligation to facilitate any kind of relationship between the father and her child, her children, even if the court has mandated some kind of visitation. So this has been a subject of a lot of concern for quite some time. But yes, some people in Japan are arguing that joint custody is not a good thing. They say that in cases of domestic violence, it's much better for one parent to simply get sole custody and they don't have to maintain a relationship with their former partner. Some Japanese justice officials have also said that sometimes sole custody is better in cases where parents disagree about the best way to bring up a child. For instance, they said, if the parents can't agree on what school the child should go to.
This will be quite an emotional issue, though.
Absolutely. Some of the stories we've heard come up in court. For example, a 54-year-old man, he divorced his wife 11 years ago when his son was just a year and a half old. He says he hasn't seen his son since, simply because his former wife wife won't allow him to see his child. And so he gave quite emotional testimony talking about how he simply tried to forget about his child because there's nothing that he can do. The government won't enforce that visitation right.
Celia Hatton. They've been on the run for more than two decades. Now they've been run down in the Ivory Coast. A Belgian couple, the fraudster Jean-Claude Lacotte and his partner Hilda van Acker, had already been given life sentences in absentia for the killing of a British businessman. Belgian prosecutors want the couple extradited. Kevin Connolly reports from Brussels.
Jean-Claude Lacotte is a con man who specialised in fake finance deals with wealthy businessmen. He and his partner murdered Marcus Mitchell when one of their crimes was uncovered. Lacotte fled with his then-girlfriend Hilda van Acker, and they spent time in South Africa, where at one point he found work editing a true crime television programme. When he was eventually jailed for fraud, van Acker helped him escape from a high-security prison by posing as a police officer sent to collect him as part of a criminal investigation. The couple eventually married. The Belgian police commissioner, Martin van Steenbrugger, said he'd been hunting Hilda van Acker for most of his working life and added that the arrests were particularly good news for the widow of Marcus Mitchell.
Kevin Connolly in Brussels. In Nigeria, there's growing demand for mental health care, but with just 130 psychiatrists serving a population of some 200 million people, the West African country is struggling to provide it, according to the World Health Organization. Victor Ugo is a Nigerian doctor who had been diagnosed with depression. He founded the Mentally Aware Nigeria Initiative, or MAN-E. And here in London, at a recent conference on African mental health, he spoke to my colleague Manuela Saragossa.
I had been diagnosed with depression when I was in medical school, and I was able to receive help for it. I knew my professors in psychiatry, for example, so it was easy to get diagnosed and get help. And I had a good set of friends who were like a community for me. So when I finished medical school and I went to see a psychiatrist in the US...
Because you continued your studies there?
Yeah, I just went to practice. The psychiatrist was Nigerian, and he told me, you're very lucky. I'm thinking, why does he think that I'm lucky, even though I have a mental health issue, you know? He dawned on me that I was one of the less than 1% of people that could access quality help. I felt like I needed to create that kind of community that I had. I would just like take that small pilots of a community that I had at the beginning when I was diagnosed and create that for other young persons in Nigeria.
We're talking here at the conference about innovation in mental health care in Africa. Is MAN-E an example of this kind of innovation? What do you bring to the table?
Years before we started up, there was little on the conversation about mental health in the country, and we used a very innovative way to change that, to get young people who had good following and influencers on social media who were interested in mental health to come on the WhatsApp group. We posted key messages from our pages on mental health and they shared it. So we were able to reach more people and get more people interested in the concept. So we had cool events that we created where you can have a conversation about mental health at the beach or in the park. You sit down and you talk about those very difficult issues. We have more than 2,000 volunteers across Nigeria. On our pages, we get people saying, I wasn't willing to talk about my mental health issue, but because I saw this story or I saw this publication or I saw just your speech on this, I was able to confront that and come to you for help.
How are you today then?
Good. So I do have bad days. I have days where I have no reason to feel bad that I feel bad. I do have days where I feel like I'm not getting better. I'm constantly on medications. I go for therapy. So I do take care of my mental health. So today I'm good. Let's see how tomorrow is.
Victor Ugo speaking to Manuela Saragossa. Not so long ago, there was a viral post on Facebook which suggested that emergency services operators in the US were trained to understand that a request from a 911 caller for pizza was in fact a cry for help. That turned out to be false. But a true case in the state of Ohio has shown that tactic being used successfully. The BBC's Jonathan Savage has the story.
This is not how most 911 calls start out.
911.
I would like to order a pizza.
In fact, probably understandably, Tim Tenek thought the call was a waste of time.
You called 911 to order a pizza?
Yeah, apartment.
This is the wrong number to call for a pizza.
But it didn't take long until he twigged that something serious was going on.
No, you're not.
I'm getting you now.
What was going on was that the woman's mother was being attacked and she couldn't risk letting the attacker know who she was really on the phone to. Very quickly, Tim and the caller understood how they had to communicate.
Is the other guy still there?
Yeah. I need a large pizza.
All right. How about medical? You need medical?
No. With pepperoni.
One of the reasons Tim Tenek knew how to respond is that he'd seen similar situations on social media. As officers drove to the scene, he made sure they knew how delicate the situation was.
Turn your sirens off before you get there. Caller ordered a pizza and agreed with everything I said that there's domestic violence going on.
The pizza tactic has been talked about since at least 2010, when the Norwegian Women's Shelter Association used it in a campaign to highlight domestic violence. In the UK, people who can't speak about their emergency are advised to remain silent, then key in the number 55 when prompted. But in the US, the National Emergency Number Association said last year that operators are not trained to listen out for any specific code word, and it can be dangerous to assume they are. On this occasion, thanks to Tim Tenek's quick thinking, police were able to help. The alleged attacker was arrested and detained.
Jonathan Savage. For the past four decades, new cars have generally been fitted with a catalytic converter, a part that helps limit the harmful emissions produced by the engine. These obscure auto parts contain valuable metals, platinum, palladium and rhodium. And in recent years, this has made them a prime target for thieves. In fact, here in the UK, the number of catalytic converters being stolen from cars has jumped tenfold so far this year. My colleague Russell Padmore spoke to Jack Cousins, a representative of Britain's Automobile Association.
Thieves are stealing converters because they want to get to that precious metal, and ultimately that's where they make their value. So they're taking them to scrap markets, or they're even going on the black market too.
Those metals have gone up in value, haven't they, quite recently? That's the greater attraction for these thieves.
Yes, it is. Palladium has skyrocketed in the very recent past.
How easy are catalytic converters to steal then?
They're either jacking up the front of a car, or where a car has got high ground clearance, they're sliding underneath, unscrewing, or they're using saws to basically hack the converter off. And what the thieves are gambling on, even when they do it in broad daylight, is that somebody is not going to question somebody tinkering underneath the car.
What can car owners do to prevent it?
Park in a garage or in a well-lit area with CCTV, or they can contact their manufacturer. And manufacturers are creating an anti-tamper device which is fitted to the converter, and it also gives the converter a unique serial number, which means it can be tracked.
Jack Cousins of the Automobile Association. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.